There's a lot here in this topic. Some of you have thought about it. Some of you have maybe taken courses on environmental economics or some other course dealing with the environment. And it's not something that Austrians talk about as much as, say, entrepreneurship or the business cycle or other maybe some public policy issues. But it's something I think is important because environmental policy has become one of the main inroads of government into our lives. It has rapidly expanded as a proportion of government intervention in the last several decades, and I think we need to understand how to deal with that, not just as people who are concerned with liberty, but as budding Austrian economists, as many of you are. We don't deal with these issues in quite the same way as most economists. Now, I took environmental economics. I had a fairly typical Chicago-style approach to it. When I was working on my dissertation, I did my dissertation on environmental regulation, a really narrow part of environmental regulation. And I went up to the Political Economy Research Center, PERC, up in Montana, and worked on my dissertation up there. And that is the it's a very good institution, but their approach is typically Chicago-esque in style and method. So I as I've thought about this some more, and as I've read what Austrians have to offer, I find that our approach has to be different from the mainstream economist perspective, and certainly is going to be different from the typical public policy perspective on environment, which is that markets fail and markets can't handle environmental problems, and therefore we have to introduce the government to take care of us in that regard. There are two basic subsets of environmental issues. One is environmental resource use. Are we running out of oil? Are we running out of trees? Are we endangering some species with extinction? That kind of thing. And then there are the externality issues. And typically you'll see environmental economics divided up into these two pieces. Externalities, for those of you that are not familiar with that term, that really refers to the spillover effects of your actions on somebody else. If I'm smoking a cigarette and you're bothered by that, then I'm creating a negative externality. Maybe you like it. I mean, one of the difficulties of an externality theory is trying to figure out what's a negative externality and what's a positive externality. If I'm smoking and my smoking reminds you of your grandfather and that brings back pleasant memories or something, then maybe that's a positive externality for you. So it's very difficult to just say, well, this category of action has to be negative. It may not be negative for everyone. It may not be negative to the same extent. So the same actions can create positive and negative side effects. These two branches of environmental economics really aren't as different as they might appear. Externalities, after all, boil down to questions over the ownership of a particular resource. Who owns the air? Who owns the water? Who owns the oceans or the rivers that may be polluted in some way? There are three basic approaches to dealing with environmental problems. One is the Pigouvian approach, named for A.C. Pigou, who was working in welfare economics maybe 100 years ago or so. And typically what you'll see from the Pigouvian approach is taxes or subsidies. We tax those things that create negative externalities. We subsidize those things that create positive externalities. And the ideal would be to try to get these negative externalities reduced and increase or enhance the positive externalities. And we'll see some of the problems with that approach in a few minutes. The other approach, I would say, is the regulatory approach. The government doesn't necessarily tax or subsidize, but would instead force people to reduce the activity that is creating the negative externality. So, for example, the government might require people to put a catalytic converter in their car or exhaust gas recirculation or some other kind of technology that requires people to cut back on their emissions. And again, the hope would be that they would reduce the emissions to the point where it's socially efficient. And then you have the property rights approach, which says, well, if you just assign property rights, or at least clarify property rights over resources, then people can negotiate on their own and sort out the trespasses and the other intrusions onto someone else's property that might occur. Now, I think it's important, and we'll get into this later, to distinguish between the Austrian approach and the Coasean approach. Ronald Coase, who won the Nobel Prize around 20 years ago in economics, largely for a very, very famous, widely cited article in the Journal of Law and Economics from 1960. I think it was 1960, 59 or 60. The Coasean approach has become widely accepted, not only among Chicago School economists, but among many others. And he's that's been a matter of some great controversy, but I think it's important to understand what he said and the problem with that from the Austrian perspective. One of the two readings that I mentioned as you should have a link to those on the online schedule. One of the two readings is an article by Roy Cordato in the 2004 issue of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. The other, by the way, is Murray Rothbard's essay, Law, Property Rights, and Air Pollution, which is about 30 years old now. But those two would give you a good idea of how Austrian economists tend to think about environmental issues. Well, according to Cordato, there are several major problems with the mainstream approach. One is that efficiency is an individual goal-seeking problem. It's not a value maximization problem. We can't assess value as a third party. I don't know what the value of a ton of coal is. I don't know what the value of a kilowatt hour of electricity is. I don't know what the value of peace and quiet is. There are all kinds of goods that we enjoy, and I can't assess those values for somebody else. So maximizing the value of resources is not a meaningful policy goal for economists. And from the Austrian perspective, we can only say that efficiency is attained when legal institutions allow people to take means at their disposal and use those means to accomplish their goals. Secondly, Cordato says that costs are subjective, cannot be measured. You've heard that probably several times this week in various talks. We don't know what costs are. The mainstream approach requires some kind of measurement of costs. We have marginal private benefit, marginal private cost, marginal social cost. Those things are not measurable. And if you take a typical environmental economics course, you're going to see something like this graph. You're going to see, for example, this marginal private benefit curve here. As the quantity of output increases, marginal private benefit would tend to decline. You would also see rising marginal private cost, MPC, right here. So the private producer is going to tend to produce a quantity of output where the marginal private cost and the marginal private benefit are equal. So that's what the individual producer is going to tend to produce. The alleged problem here is that the cost to everybody else have to be piled on top of the cost to the individual producer. So not only do you have the private cost to the emitter of the producer, you have some additional cost to the rest of society, which gives us this marginal social cost. So in order to get this MSC curve, what we've done is we've added the marginal private cost to a social cost, and you'll notice the gap between these two lines is getting larger, so that marginal social cost is increasing. So if you wanted to have the efficient quantity of production, according to the mainstream view, you'd have to find this location here where the marginal social cost and the marginal private cost are equal, right here. And that would give us Q star, the ideal quantity of output. That's where public policy would try to push us. All right. Well, if costs are subjective, we can't measure marginal social cost. We can't measure marginal social benefit for those things that might be creating a positive externality. There's no way to do this. Is my cigarette smoking affecting a bystander? How much? How would we compare that to the extent to which my cigarette smoking is benefiting me? Which, if that sounds a little odd, we can have a conversation about that later, but clearly cigarette smoking does benefit people because otherwise they wouldn't do it. And if you say, well, they're addicted, they can't help it, they have to smoke. Well, they didn't have to smoke the first one. Evidently, they saw some kind of benefit. Anyway, that's maybe a discussion for another day. But the third problem that Cordato points out is that human action takes place over time. So, again, one of the things you'd be likely to see and hear about in an economics course on the environment would be Pareto optimality, Pareto superiority, and you'd see some kind of box like this. This is called Edgeworth-Bowley box. If you haven't seen that before, don't worry. It's not going to be a test on this particular thing later. But basically what they try to do is they take indifference curves and try to find the point where, and there's a set of points here along this line, where any movement from this point will not make anybody better off without making somebody else worse off. One of the assumptions you have to make in order to conduct this kind of analysis is that you can make some kind of interpersonal utility comparison. You'd have to be able to, once more, compare my benefit from conducting an activity to your cost when I do that same activity. We can't do that. All right, so what are some of the implications of this? We have these three problems with the mainstream approach, which lead Austrians to differ with the mainstream on several important issues. What about over-extraction of resources or overuse of resources, like in a tragedy of the commons? You've probably heard that language before. Tragedy of the commons just means that when you've got some commonly owned resource, a pasture, an ocean, a river, where there's no clear owner, then you're going to have multiple people trying to use this pasture, and there will be overgrazing of the pasture since nobody has the ability to say, no, stop, you're using more than is likely to generate the maximum value for this property. Well, one of the fundamental problems with trying to figure out over-extraction issues is that we know the optimal rate of use. In order to be over something, you have to know what that level, that optimal level would be. We can't know that. We can't know where, if you go back to the previous diagram, we can't know where the marginal social benefit and the marginal social cost are equal. And if we can't know that, we can't know what over-extraction looks like. And if we don't know that optimal point, that Q star, if we don't know where the ideal quantity of output would be, we can't assess the appropriate tax. And for positive externalities, we can't assess the appropriate subsidy. So if we don't know, how do we make a sensible public policy out of the matter? All right, well, I know some people will say, we don't know exactly what the extra cost in society is, but we know that it's something. We know that this factory that's belching sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere is creating some kind of cost, Therefore, some kind of tax would be appropriate. That's not acceptable either, because it is possible with a tax to push us back to a point where the loss to society is even greater than was the case at the privately determined level of output. So we're stuck. We cannot determine the appropriate tax or subsidy. If you go to tradable permits, that itself doesn't solve the problem either. You're pushing the problem off onto a bureaucrat who has to then decide how many permits do we then need to issue. If we don't know how many permits to issue, we can't tell. There's no way to solve the problem. Well, Austrians even would differ on the definition of pollution. What is pollution? Well, the mainstream would say it's some emission that generates a situation in which the marginal social benefits are less than the marginal social cost. You're over there on that QM on the diagram earlier. You're not a Q star, so there's pollution. But we don't know the benefits or costs. We know that some emissions create benefits and costs. For example, I read several years ago that the Hershey chocolate factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, used to produce this really nice-smelling chocolate smell in the town. And I would like that. Maybe there's some people offended by that, but I would think that, well, for me, that's a positive thing. On my way to work every day, I used to pass a bakery. It's now shut down, but it was a bakery that produced this nice smell, to me, nice smell of baking bread. I thought, well, that's nice. I like that. Well, according to what I was reading, the Hershey Chocolate Factory had to eliminate its emissions of that chocolate odor, because along with the emissions apparently came some kind of chemical that was controlled by the EPA. So the EPA made them cut back on whatever this other chemical was that they didn't think was appropriate, and also in the process that killed off the chocolate odor. Well, here we have something that was generating something that clearly had some benefits as well as possibly some costs, and was that emission from the Hershey Chocolate Factory pollution or not? We don't really know. So we can't really determine whether particular emissions are pollution. If we can't do that, we really are stuck when it comes to creating some kind of welfare-enhancing policy. Furthermore, the Austrian would say you cannot have costs to the environment. You can have costs to an individual. You can have costs to a group of individuals. But you can't have costs to an environment. So the issue then becomes a matter of violating the property rights of a person, not about exceeding some level of emissions or damaging the environment. If somebody plants trees, is that damaging to the environment? Maybe. But it depends on what my intended use of that property would be. Maybe my use of the property was to provide some kind of bed and breakfast hotel that had a nice view of the mountains in the distance, and when my next door neighbor decided to plant trees, they grew up to a height such that it blocked the view of the mountains from my clients, my customers. Even planting trees is something that may sound like it's pretty good for the environment, could actually be detrimental to some purposes, some uses of the environment. So we cannot divorce the changes in the environment from individual intentions, individual costs. Roy Cotato says that pollution is therefore not about harming the environment, but about human conflict over the use of physical resources. Humans, he says, change the environment in such a way that it harms others who might be planning to use it for conflicting purposes. So the issue then is not a matter of exceeding a level of emissions, but of violating the property rights or person of some individual. Carl Menger pointed this out long ago. He said that when all members of society compete for a given quantity of goods that is insufficient, that is, scarce, a practical solution to this conflict of interest is only conceivable if the various portions of the whole amount at the disposal of society, that is, if the goods pass into the control or possession of some of the individuals, and if those individuals' property rights are then protected. So in other words, Menger's suggesting that one of the ways to deal with environmental problems is to assign ownership or recognize ownership over property. All right. Well, of course, we have to deal with this man here, Ronald Coase, and what he said. Maybe you've heard of the Coase theorem, maybe not, but if you're an economics student, it's going to be unavoidable at some point. You will read about this, and you'll have to try to understand Coase and all of his all the implications of Coase. Well, the Coase theorem suggests that if you don't have any transaction costs, that is, if two parties can bargain with each other at zero cost, then the ultimate outcome in a technical sense will be the same regardless of who is granted property rights over the resource by the courts. So we know, and also Coase knew, that transaction costs aren't zero. Some people will say, well, in a Coasean world, transaction costs are zero. Well, no. In fact, I listened to an interview with the 102-year-old Ronald Coase a few weeks ago, in which he mentioned this. He's not saying that transaction costs actually are zero. In fact, we do have this. We do have costs of bargaining and coming to various arrangements with other people. So courts then would have to decide on who's got the property rights, and they would have to make a decision. And that decision would affect the well-being of both parties. This is Harold Demsetz, one of those who have defended Coase. And incidentally, there's a fairly well-known exchange between our Walter Block and Harold Demsetz in the pages of the Review of Austrian Economics on Coase and Coasean, the Coase theorem. And if you have a chance to read that exchange, that should be quite profitable for you. So one of the key problems with the Coasean approach is that it neglects the problem of subjectivity of costs and benefits. So one of the classic examples from this lengthy article from Coase from 1960 is the railroad versus the farmer. And the railroad, old-time railroads, coal-fired, is throwing off sparks from the locomotive, and the sparks land in the neighborhood or in the neighboring fields of the farmer and burn off some of the crop and clearly produce some costs for the farmer. So let's look at this and see how Coase would view it, and then once we introduce the Austrian perspective on costs, how that would change our view of that same situation, why I think Coase is wrong on this. All right. So we have orchards destroyed by sparks from a passing train. And let's suppose the farmer has a $115,000 piece of property. That is, to the farmer, the market value, I shouldn't say
to the farmer.
To the market, the value of the property is $115,000. All right. And that is primarily because the farmer can use this property for growing these trees. The farmer, just for the sake of simplicity here, has no other resources. This is his only asset, and he has to earn his income off of the product of his orchard. Let's suppose also that the railroad has would have to incur a cost of $120,000 if it were to install spark reduction devices on its locomotives. So COSA is going to say, if the transaction costs are zero, then whether the court rules in favor of the farmer or the court rules in favor of the railroad, you're still going to get the same outcome. That is, either the spark devices will be installed and their damage to the farmer will cease, or the spark devices won't be installed and the farmer will continue to suffer the damage. But whichever of those two outcomes occurs, if transaction costs are zero, then the court decision is really just a matter of determining the starting point of a negotiation between those two parties. So, case one, let's suppose the court rules in favor of the farmer. So the railroad then comes to the farmer and says, all right, well, look, it's going to cost us $120,000 to comply with the order from the court. So would you accept a payment from us of $100,000 to continue to put up with the damage to your orchard? And what would the farmer say? Likely. I mean, the farmer may not know how high the railroad's willing to go on this. The railroad's willing to go to $120,000. There may be some bargaining room in there, but at a minimum, the farmer would say, okay, $100,000 will compensate me for my damage. You can go ahead and throw your sparks and save yourself $120,000. Okay. So the devices are not installed. Trees are gone, burned, whatever, and society, made up of the farmer and the railroads, gained by $20,000. Railroad does not have to install this device, expensive device. All right, well, case two is the court rules in favor of the railroad. So the railroad gets the rights. The farmer now is not going to be able to pay $120,000 to the railroad to get the railroad to install the device. The property as a whole has a market value of only $115,000. There's no way for the farmer to cough up the money to get the railroad to stop. So the devices, again, are not installed, and again, the trees are gone. And according to this analysis, society again gains because the most efficient solution is obtained rather than incurring a $120,000 cost of installing this spark suppressor. We instead suffer the loss of $100,000 orchard. So according to the highest value of the resource, we have obtained that, if not from the initial decision of the court, then by some negotiation after the fact by the farmer and the railroad. All right. Now, here's where the Austrian would say, now, wait a minute, you've missed something and possibly something extremely important. What if the farmer suffers another loss, something that is not reflected in the market value of the property? He's got a peculiar but definite attachment to these trees, to him worth $900,000. In addition to the market value. All right. You think, well, that's kind of weird. Why would anybody have a peculiar attachment to trees like that? Well, there are people that have peculiar attachments to trees. But you know, you can imagine some not so contrived situations where this might be the case. Well, suppose you have a family farm and your family's had this property for five generations, and great-great-great-grandmother's buried on the back property there, and you know, you have fond childhood memories of playing in the yard in the back of the all these other things that you might remember from your childhood, and this is valuable to you. Selling the farm for the market value and finding some other physically equivalent farm just wouldn't be quite the same. Might not even be close to being the same to you. People do have real sentimental attachments, psychological attachments to various things. I'm wearing a little band of gold around my finger. This is my wedding ring that I obtained from my wife, but it has even more sentimental value because this is the wedding ring that belonged to my father. So you could weigh this and you could say, well, that's X amount of gold in that, so the market value of this wedding ring would be, I don't know what it would be, $300 or something. If we would be making you whole if we took the ring and gave you $300. No. Afraid not. And if I have to say that, by the way, but even if I didn't have to say that, that would be true. So people have non-marketable values they attach to various things that they own. All right. So how does this affect our analysis here? Now we still have got this $120,000 cost of the spark reduction device. And let's suppose that in this case, the court rules in favor of the railroad. All right. So we know that the total market value of the property is only $115,000. But there's no way the farmer, we said that this is the only asset belonging to the farmer. He doesn't have a bank account somewhere. There's nothing else marketable that he can sell off. This is it. Just for simplicity, this is the way I set it up. So there's no way that the farmer can have enough liquid assets to pay the railroad enough money to install the spark suppressor. Therefore, the devices are not installed as before, as Coase would predict. The trees are gone. And in this case, society, made up of the railroad and the farmer, loses. You have $120,000 saved by not installing the spark suppressor, minus $100,000 market loss of the orchard. But additionally, you have to subtract the psychological loss, which again is real, even though it's not tangible. It's a real subjective cost to the farmer of $900,000. So we have cost society by this decision $880,000. This is not welfare enhancing. All right. This drives us to where, well, Rothbard says that this drives us to the realm of ethics. He says we cannot decide on public policy, tort law, rights, or liabilities on the basis of efficiencies or the minimizing of costs. Now, tort law is how Austrians would tend to suggest that we ought to deal with these things because we cannot measure these subjective costs and benefits sufficiently to allow the government to determine what the proper amount of some resource use might be, or what the ideal amount of sparks being thrown from a railroad might be. There's no way to determine that. So we're left with tort law, which at least preserves the possibility of maintaining that psychological or subjective value of property to the owners. All right. Well, under tort law, if somebody aggresses against another individual by invading their property or affecting their person with pollution, they can be held strictly liable in a court and required to stop. There may be some recovery of damages assigned, which requires the polluter to pay. Now, another distinctive here is that if payment is made by the polluter, it's not paid to the government as a tax. It's paid to the victim. Coasean approach, by the way, does away with the distinction between the victim and the perpetrator. It says, well, it doesn't really matter who was there first. It doesn't really matter who's emitting the pollution. What matters is the best or highest value of the resource. All right. A harm under the law of torts is generally treated as a physical invasion of your person or property. So to be a tortious assault and subject to some kind of legal action, the tort law would require the threat to be near and imminent. All right. So, again, Rothbard in this Law of Property and Air Pollution, Law of Property Rights and Air Pollution essay that I mentioned earlier says that no action should be considered illicit or illegal unless it invades or aggresses against the person or just property of another. Only invasive actions, he says, should be declared illegal and combated with the full power of the law. He says the invasion must be concrete and physical. All right. He says it has to be a physical invasion. That means it can't just be that the value of your property fell. Why? The value of your property, the market value, is the assessment of other people as to what your property would be worth to them. You don't have a title to the opinions of other people or the valuations of other people as to what your property could do for them. So this is not something to be corrected by law. Now, you'll sometimes see this in discussions, maybe in a business ethics class or something. Walmart becomes the favorite whipping boy of the business ethicists, and they'll say, well, you know, Walmart comes into an area, and they build this giant store, and mom-and-pop stores end up folding because they can't compete with Walmart. They lose all their customers to Walmart. And there's a little bit of the language we use when we talk about that kind of situation that betrays something. We said the mom-and-pop store loses their customers to Walmart. Whose customers? Customers don't belong to anybody except to themselves. Customers didn't belong to the mom and pops, and if the customers on their own decided they'd rather shop at Walmart than shop at the mom and pop, that's up to the customers. Walmart evidently offered something that was more attractive. There's a combination of quality and price and so forth than the mom and pops were. Incidentally, even construing this as some kind of battle between, you know, David and Goliath and the mom and pop and the giant Walmart is a little bit misleading, because a lot of times the primary opponents of the Walmart are not mom and pops. They're the supermarkets, giant food stores and other things, which is a little ironic since supermarkets themselves were accused of the very same kind of mom and pop killer status about 100 years ago when A&P started up as a competitor to some of the genuine mom and pop grocery stores. Again, that's probably a discussion for another day. But the main point here is that the value of your property is not something you have title to. This follows along. I won't elaborate on this, but it follows along with what Schumpeter called creative destruction. The Rothbardian approach here avoids the reasonable man approach of the law that we commonly see today, and instead would turn to a strict liability approach. He would say anybody has the right to defend his property against an overt act initiated against it, and he says a strict causal connection must exist between the aggressor and a victim, and that connection must be provable beyond a reasonable doubt. All right, well, we have this idea of homesteading. If you are the first one to use a piece of property for a particular purpose, then you have homesteaded this property. That use of it becomes yours. Maybe not all aspects of the property, but at least that use of it becomes yours. And any violation or any intrusion into your use of that property then becomes a trespass that you could, or a nuisance that you could then try to use the courts to stop. Well, that applies to noise, for example. If I'm living by myself on a large piece of acreage, and to entertain my kids, every night I take them out and I launch off some fireworks. I think this is great. My kids think this is great. And then I have somebody move in close enough to me that they're annoyed by the regular displays of fireworks, and they take me to court, sue me for nuisance. Under the homesteading doctrine, we'd say, look, I've been doing this for a regular period of time. I have homesteaded this right to create this fireworks show, and because of that, you don't have a case. Air pollution may work the same way, and again, I would refer you to Rothbard's 1982 piece on this. Air can be used for a variety of purposes. It can be used as a dumping ground for waste. It can be used as a source of breathable air. It can be used for a variety of purposes. And you, if you have been using air for one of those purposes and somebody comes along later and says, well, you can't use it for that purpose because I'm wanting to use it for my purpose, that's where your homesteading right trumps their desire to use the air for some other purpose. We could think of a variety of pollution problems that could be resolved by an appeal to that kind of doctrine. So let's suppose, for example, that an airport is established with a great deal of land around it. Airport's creating noise. A housing development then buys land near the airport, and sometime later the homeowners sue the airport because there's excessive noise interfering with use and enjoyment of their homes. Well, the airport owns the right to emit X number of decibels of noise in the manner that they have been accustomed to. Now, if they decide they're going to bring in the Concorde jet, which they didn't do before, and they're going to launch this thing off their airstrip, and it creates some kind of Mach 1 sonic boom over the houses, that's different. That's increasing their noise emissions to the point where they had not homesteaded that that right. There's a case mentioned in Coase's 1960 article. And he doesn't take the case the same way I would, or I think Rothbard would, but he mentions this Bove versus Donner Hanna Coke Company. Coke is a derivative of coal. This is not the beverage we're talking about here. And the plaintiff had moved into an industrial region where the defendant was operating a coke oven on the opposite side of the street. When the plaintiff tried to go to court to enjoin or force the coke oven to stop, the court rejected the plea, and it said, quote, with all the dirt, smoke, and gas which necessarily come from factory chimneys, trains, and boats, and with full knowledge that this region was especially adapted for industrial rather than residential uses, no zoning here now, this is the way things have been, that's what the courts are saying, and that factories would increase in the future, plaintiff selected this locality as the site of her future home. She voluntarily moved into this district, fully aware of the fact that the atmosphere would constantly be contaminated by dirt, gas, and foul odors, and that she could not hope to find in this locality the pure air of a strictly residential zone. She evidently saw certain advantages in living in this congested center. This is not the case of an industry with its attendant noise and dirt invading a quiet residential district. This is just the opposite. Here, A residence is built in an area naturally adapted for industrial purposes and already dedicated to that use. In other words, the industry has homesteaded, even though the court's not using that term, has homesteaded the right to continue this activity, using the air to dump their particulates, using the air for the dispersal of their noise and other odors and fumes and various things that might result from their processes. So the court says, the plaintiff can hardly be heard to complain at this late date that her peace and comfort have been disturbed by a situation which existed at the very time she bought her property. Now, as Cordato points out, this case and some others will illustrate that the responsibility for internalizing costs does not automatically go to the people that are generating the byproduct, the smoke or the fumes or the odor. They're not necessarily the ones responsible for adjusting to the situation. The newcomer is responsible for adjusting to the situation. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip over the trespass versus nuisance and the boundary crossing here. Rothbard talks about visible and tangible invasions versus insensible invasions, and he basically says the only ones you really have to worry about, the only ones subject to court cases would be the ones that affect your senses. If you can't tell that somebody's cell phone waves are passing through your body, if it causes you no damage that you can prove, then you have no case. It has to be something that's sensible, tangible, or causes some kind of harm that you can connect to the actions of the emitter. I had somebody ask me shortly before my talk, what would happen if you've got multiple emitters? Kind of hard to file a lawsuit against several million car owners if they are all generating some kind of emissions, which individually might be insignificant, but collectively might be seriously harmful. And while I'm not suggesting that I'm not suggesting that in a fully libertarian world that no problems would exist, I don't subscribe to libertarian utopianism, I do think that in a society which reduces government ownership of resources, you will tend to have fewer of these problems. Who owns the roads that these cars that are emitting some gases into the atmosphere? Who owns the roads that these cars are driving on? There's certainly a far smaller number of road owners than car drivers. And I think that if you had road ownership in private hands instead of government hands, the target of the lawsuits could then be the owners of the roads, which have customers using their property and in the process emitting some kind of fumes into the air. That could be the proper target of a lawsuit. Not millions and millions of car owners. I'm not suggesting that there wouldn't be some remainder of cases in which large numbers might continue to be a problem, but Rothbard, at least, is very clear that class action lawsuits are not the way to resolve this. That would require people who did not participate in the suit to be bound by the lawsuit's outcome. I would like to allow some time for questions, let me just mention here in closing that when we try to compare when we try to evaluate the role of the state in reducing pollution, we have to consider two very, very serious problems that the state runs into. These were mentioned. I was just in Bob Higgs' talk upstairs before lunch, and he mentioned these same problems in some form. One is a socialist calculation problem. It's a knowledge problem. I mentioned this at the very first part of my talk. How does the government know what the ideal quantity of some chemical might be in the atmosphere? It can't know that. It does not have information. And furthermore, when you abolish the price system in favor of some kind of regulatory solution, you abolish one of the best sources of information we have. So the government faces first a knowledge problem, and secondly, it faces a, you can call it an incentive incompatibility, you can call it a principal-agent problem, you can call it a public choice problem, but basically it's the problem that emerges when an agent of the government has motivations that differ to some extent from what is best for the rest of society. When you've got bureaucrats that are looking after their own paychecks, their own kids' college educations, their own reputations, their own political aspirations, that will often lead them in directions that are counter to what is best for the rest of society. And those two problems, I think, should cause us to at least have a healthy degree of skepticism about the appropriateness of government taxes, subsidies, or regulations. I've got some more, but I'll stop here because I think that probably the most fruitful thing to do at this point would be to allow you to ask questions you might have about environmental economics. So I'll stop here. Yes. I do. Well, it's the one of the problems with grandfather, and I haven't thought very carefully about this, but I will say that one of the problems with grandfather clauses is that they tend to be oriented toward the technical requirements on a firm rather than the actual emissions of the firm. So, and they're often used as a kind of a way for special interest groups to gain some monopoly power. For example, one of the Clean Air Act amendments, I think it was the 1990 set of Clean Air Act amendments, put such stringent requirements on the construction of new coke ovens that one of the commentators at the time said, we'll never get a new coke oven built in the United States because they can't meet the regulations. But the old ones who did not have to meet the regulations continued to operate with their old technology. Now, who benefits from this? Clearly, the old coke oven manufacturers are guarding themselves against new upstart, perhaps more innovative, perhaps cleaner competition. Maybe not as clean as the regulation requires, but an improvement nonetheless. So, yeah, I think grandfather clauses will often act to enhance monopoly power or gain restrict entry into an industry and not really serve to reduce emissions. They may, in fact, increase emissions. If emissions are dropping steadily as technology improves, which we tend to see, the grandfather clauses may freeze the technology at a certain level and prevent the continuation of a decline in emissions and make our environment worse off than it would have been otherwise. Other questions? Yes. I would say yes, they would attach to that property. If I sell my home and somebody else moves in behind me, I don't think that the rights that I had would somehow disappear. I actually do live near an airport. And occasionally, sometimes late at night, there will be large cargo aircraft flying near my house. And if I sold my house, I don't know that the new tenant would have the right to complain about that. Did you have something to add to that? Yes. Right. And easement, typically the way the word is used would be a formalized access to a property or permission to use a property in a certain narrowly defined way. So I can issue an easement for somebody to cross my property on the way to their house if their house is locked in by my property. And in fact, courts will sometimes recognize those rights even if they have not been established by some document. If my neighbor's been crossing my property for 20 years to get to my neighbor's barn or something, and then all of a sudden my neighbor and I have some kind of quarrel and I decide I don't want him crossing my property anymore, he could take me to court and I think would quite properly win a case against me and say, well, I've been doing this. You've allowed it for many years. You've essentially granted me a homesteaded right to continue to use the property in that fashion. Yes. Okay. Well, yes, that's it. There you go. Other questions? Right here in the sweatshirt.
A common law scholar named Roger Meyer speaks.
Yeah.
And he's really good.
Yeah.
He was saying that in cases where there are many, many polluters and many victims, like common law kind of breaks down and the statute is almost necessary. I'm somewhat favorable to this position. I don't know if you skipped over it, or I feel like I missed it.
I added to my talk this year substantially from last year, and unfortunately, time got eaten up on some other things, but. I think that while I enjoy a lot of the things that Dr. Miners has written, I would differ with him on that because statutory, in fact, coincidentally, Rothbard here says administrative rules, statutory rules are illegitimate. They're invasive. He's not one to mince words. There are criminal interference with the property rights of non-criminals. When you create a statute, you're not just constraining the activities of people who have trespassed or created some nuisance. You're also constraining the activities of people who have done nothing wrong. And so from an ethical standpoint, the government has trespassed itself on the freedom of other people to use their property as they will. And any statute requires governments to make these assessments of that crossing point where marginal social costs, marginal social benefits, or marginal private benefits connect. And while I think I understand the motivation behind that, theoretically it is flawed. Well, a lot of the pollution in L.A., as I understand it, is due to automobiles. And again, I think once you privatize certain common access resources like roads, then I think that the large numbers problem of lawsuits diminishes substantially. I can't say that would happen in every case, but I think that at least in that particular case and a substantial number of others, it would resolve much of the problem. A lot of our pollution, by the way, is not generated by any human activity whatsoever. We don't recognize that. Volatile organic compounds emitted by trees and various chemicals emitted by volcanoes and forest fires and other things. Not something that have not been perpetrated by anybody. And that's another consideration I didn't get much into here. Back in the back, blue shirt.
Yeah. When you said that humans homesteaded the air first, refresh here, and therefore any other human beings have homesteaded the air since humans
which humans?
Humans homesteaded the air first for fresh breathing. So therefore, since we've been breathing air for quite a while in all parts of the world, another company would be aggressing against that homesteaded, right?
Well,
by what you were saying in your speech, that would make sense in my mind. We were there first breathing air.
First of all, I can transfer a right that I've got to somebody else. I can choose to put up with somebody's emissions. And in fact, people do this. They move into an area, they build a house, they know that this is a pollution problem, and they're willing to deal with that because they know that this factory over here is going to give them a job too, and they value the job more. That's perfectly all right. Furthermore, there are areas that are unsettled, and humans didn't exist everywhere all at the same time, and so we've got the very distinct possibility that people could move into an area and create some kind of activity that generates fumes without infringing upon any rights of people who live elsewhere. So I think that breaks down on a couple of points. I'm afraid I'm already about 3 minutes over, so I should stop. Thank you.